Good morning. I'll start off by introducing myself. My name is Chantal Leonard, and I'm a program manager on the Windows User Experience team. And for the last few years or so, I've been spending most of my time on the building and design of the new Windows 8 start screen. And what's been really interesting is being able to spend time with partners in the last 6 months or so since we started talking about Windows 8 publicly, and taking a lot of those learnings from building the Windows 8 start screen and applying them to a really large breadth of application scenarios. First, I wanted to provide a quick preview a forward on Metro and what Metro is for those who aren't already familiar with it. Metro is the name of our design language, and it takes much of its inspiration from Swiss modern design, and it shares a similar emphasis on clarity, cleanliness, reduction, and simple but beautiful visuals. And there's a great talk from Sam Moreau that was given at Build, and if you haven't seen it yet, I definitely recommend looking it up. And it's on Metro design style and the five principles of Metro design style. These are do more with less, pride in craftsmanship, be fast and fluid, authentically digital, and win as one. And what I'll be walking you through for the next hour or so is how you can take these five principles and apply them to much of your decision making as you're building Metro style applications, from the visual layout, interaction design, and overall application flow. The first principle is do more with less. And at its core, this principle is about focusing your UI on what it's really meant to be great at. And the other side of this particular principle is really elevating that content and removing distractions. So when we talk about distractions, distractions come in a lot of different forms. This is a typical Windows 7 RSS newsreader. And you'll notice a couple of things going on here. There's a lot of content on the screen, and not all of it is relevant to the primary purpose of this application, which is about reading news feeds and really finding the highlighted news feeds that I want to spend time digging into. On the left-hand side, you'll see some feed management UI. On the top, you'll see a lot of buttons, search, settings, the ability to switch views. These really end up detracting from what I primarily want to spend most of my time on as a user doing, and that's reading these feeds. And we talk about those visual distractions, all of that ancillary Chrome and functionality as Chrome. And we say that Chrome distracts users from what an app is meant to be best at. There's an interesting story that we like to share when we talk about this principle, and it's around an early usability study that we performed at the beginnings of the building of Windows 8. We brought in a number of usability participants, and we asked them to do an exercise for us. We gave them a blank piece of notepad paper, and we asked them to draw what they think of when they think of a Windows PC. And what they ended up drawing was something that looked a little bit like this in most cases. It was a rectangle with a window in it, with a taskbar, sometimes a start button, and the window had a lot of widgets on it, so you'd see a close button, maybe a minimize button, a maximize button, sometimes an allusion to things like a file menu, and a scroll bar. And then what we asked participants to do was to spend a couple hours with an early prototype build of Windows 8. And at the end of it, we asked them to do a very similar exercise. So we gave them another piece of notepad paper, and we asked them to draw what they remembered. And what they ended up drawing for us was very different. What they ended up drawing was a series of boxes that had content in it. And if you've seen some of our Metro-style apps so far, this is a very kind of common pattern that we see in applications. What people were drawing were what they remembered from the application, the content that they were seeing, the people that they were communicating with, the news articles that they were electing to tap and navigate to and to read. And this is kind of fundamentally different from this previous image, where the focus wasn't so much on the content and the ideas that an application was communicating, but instead it was about how a user was interacting with that content. It was the widgets that they were using to scroll the content or manipulate the content or how they were switching windows. And so we think that this is kind of a fundamental shift that Metro really provides to users when we think about building Metro-style applications. The focus becomes the content of the application and the ideas you're trying to convey, whether it's a shirt that a user is going to be buying or a news article that they're going to be reading. There's a really interesting tool that we've started sharing out with application designers as they start thinking about application designs and to really focus their efforts in how they're building out an application. And John, who's talking next, is going to be diving into some more of the details here. But I wanted to give a quick preview of this particular tool. And that's the BestStat statement. The BestStat statement is a way of articulating how your app is going to be fundamentally differentiating itself from other apps in the same category that or that provides similar functionality. And what it's meant to help with is really focus what ideas and content you're going to be putting front and center in your application designs. We think that a good BestStat statement is specific and focuses on differentiation and is concise. So looking back to our newsreader example, where we kind of saw that there was this huge breadth of scenarios that it was really trying to convey in that first screen, we could try to focus it down on a couple of scenarios. And so, for example, you could articulate a BestStat statement for a Metro newsreader as a newsreader being the best app in its category at helping users view the latest headlines from a personalized set of resources. And here we're trying to differentiate this newsreader from maybe other newsreaders in the same category by really focusing on headlines and on that personalized set of resources. And we're going to be showing a couple examples of how you can actually apply this to that same desktop application in a few minutes, so hold tight, but keep that BestStat statement in mind. The other strategy that we discuss when we talk about doing more with less is strategies around how you can elevate the content in the application and really reduce Chrome. And going back to some of the introduction where we were discussing Metro and what Metro means, one of the applications of modern Swiss design that we take a lot of inspiration from is its use in modern transportation signage. And one of the things that we think these do particularly well is really focus on providing a simple but clear message about what the intent of the functionality behind that signage is. And we're trying to do the same thing when it comes to applications, really kind of stripping away all of those distractions. We think that content should be at the heart of any application experience. And you should really leave only the most relevant elements on the screen. And there's a saying that we have, which is solve for distractions, not discoverability. By putting users in an application experience where the focus is on content, they're going to be immersed in the information that's most important to them. And they'll do the work to explore the rest and access functionality as it's needed. So Chrome comes from a couple of different places, typically. And if you recall the RSS newsreader example, some of these were pretty obvious just even looking at that one. They come from how you lay out content, from how you interact with the content, and how you navigate that content. And there are a couple of strategies that you can use to reduce some of that chrome. When we talk about layout, we think that you can create a lot of visual clarity by using crisp graphical elements and avoiding graphics that rely on gradients or drop shadows or other things that really kind of end up just drawing a user's attention as opposed to adding functionality. You can also remove lines and boxes as a way to group and organize content and instead rely on the intentional use of negative space. So let's take this RSS newsreader example and apply some of these strategies. You already see that just by removing some of those gradients and some of those kind of ancillary graphical elements and the lines, the focus is much more obvious. It's obvious that where I'm trying to spend most of my time is on reading the news articles and basically scanning those feeds. And space doesn't really need to be boring. It can be really beautiful. Here's an example of a music application where we're actually using the space to augment the content. Here, the content being the information related to what's playing and how far along you are in the song. So you can really augment the content and make for a more beautiful experience. The other place that Chrome can really kind of factor into an application design is in interactions. We'll often see Chrome that is meant to introduce entry points into commands. And one of the strategies that you can use very effectively to reduce a lot of the Chrome associated with content is to integrate the commands in the content. This is a sketch of a shopping application. And it seems okay, but then one of the things that you might notice here is that there are a lot of arrows. And what these arrows are doing are they're meant to provide a hint that tapping or clicking any one of these groups is going to actually navigate you to another page. But they actually end up being ancillary and unnecessary. And so one of the ways to remove this repetitive Chrome is to simply take it off screen and instead rely on the fact that users are going to tap or click whatever is on the screen. We've done a ton of usability studies that show that users will tap basically anything on the screen. So you don't really need to provide any additional hints that something is tappable. A user is just going to naturally do it. And then for things like mouse interactions, you can just rely on providing feedback like hover to really indicate when something is an interactive element without actually having to put something like an arrow on a box to indicate that something is going to navigate. Another great example of removing Chrome that's meant for commands is games. When we first started seeing games being adopted to touch platforms, what was typically done was that people were placing joystick commands or AB buttons on the canvas directly, and users actually had to target those buttons to actually manipulate the players in an application. So this is a simple application where there's a stick figure man and you can make him jump over obstacles. What we've done here is actually removed all of those ancillary commands, and instead we rely on a user tapping anywhere on the screen to actually make the stick figure jump. So I can just tap anywhere, and depending on how long I press that screen, the stick figure will jump a different amount. And this is a realization that I think a lot of user interface designers have already kind of embraced in the touch medium, but it can extend far beyond just games. And so this is something to keep in mind. How can you actually remove commands and Chrome from the application and instead rely on direct manipulation of the screen? The other example I wanted to show along those lines was the idea of a flyout. So this is my Windows 8 start screen, and I've just gone ahead and tapped on my name in, well, not my name, but JK's name on the top right-hand corner. And what you'll see here is a flyout that gives me some options for changing my account picture, locking out, or signing out. And you'll notice here that we don't have a close button here, and that's very intentional. We didn't really want to have a UI affordance that you actually had to explicitly target to close this type of transient UI. Instead, as a user, I can tap anywhere outside that flyout to dismiss it. Again, another example of removing Chrome if it's not necessary, and where a user can leverage direct manipulation to form those commands. The other strategy that you can use when you're talking about interaction and removing some of those commands from the screen is leveraging the edge. So going back to the start screen, I can swipe from the bottom and have an app bar come up. And the app bar is a UI surface that you can leverage for showing both contextual and global commands. John, who's going to be talking after me, is going to go into some more of the details here. But what's really interesting here is, by default, I don't need these commands. The commands that are in the app bar let me switch views, but most of my time is actually going to be spent in the start view. Let's say I actually wanted to look at all my applications in a more alphabetized way. I can switch the all apps view and see a different representation. There are a couple of other applications that use the edge, and we'll show a couple of additional examples. But let's go back to the RSS newsreader. And let's imagine that we've taken the time to actually change the layout significantly and embrace some of those metro-style principles of bringing some images and content to the foreground. And one of the things you'll notice here is there were a lot of commands in that desktop application, and they're not here on this landing page. Where we have placed it is actually in that bottom app bar. And so commands like refresh and removing subscriptions to specific news articles and feeds have all been placed kind of in the app bar. The other place where you can place commands, or leverage commands, I should say, is in the charms. So there are some key kind of fundamental system commands that we offer as charms that are available from the right-hand side. And we think most of these are applicable to most applications. There's going to be a session this afternoon that goes into the details of all of these specific charms, but these are search, share, devices, and settings. If you'll recall, in the desktop RSS newsreader, we did have a search and settings command. Here we've actually integrated them into the charms, and we're leveraging these contracts. And so what I've effectively done is removed all of those commands from the newsreader application. This is another example. This is a photo application. It doesn't really look like your typical photo application at first glance, but what it does really well is that it lets me stay immersed in the photo viewing experience. By default, I'm not seeing any Chrome that's getting in the way of me experiencing the photography. And then what I can do is I can swipe from the top or bottom edge to bring in some additional information, things like the title of the photo, the ability to view it online, or start a slideshow. This is the browser. By default, we're just showing you the browser content. It's letting you stay immersed in the content that you really want to be spending your time consuming. It's the website. It's not the additional commands of navigating or switching tabs. Those you can bring in on demand, again, by swiping from the bottom or top edge. So think about how you can leverage those edges to bring in commands only when they're relevant to the user, and leave them immersed in the primary ideas you're trying to communicate by default. One of the other things I alluded to was providing commands contextually. The app bar isn't really meant to be a junk drawer where you're going to put every single command all the time. So think about avoiding that. Instead, think about showing certain commands when an item is selected. So let's say I right-clicked on an item like a sandwich, a day, egg, and chorizo torta from Tortas, or I swipe down, which is the way you can select with touch. You're going to see that instead of just having the global commands around refreshing the view and adding feeds, I also have the ability to mark an individual item as red on the left-hand side. And we think of separating out these global commands, commands that are always applicable to an app, and those that are only contextual available based on the side, on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side. Here's another example that's pretty interesting. Thinking back to, again, the sketch of a shopping application. Let's say that we actually navigated into one of those categories. What you're going to see there is a list of products. And there are a couple of ways that we could expose commands on any one of those individual products. When we first started sketching out this application, the first thing we tried was actually putting those commands on each of the individual products. Again, you'll probably see a common theme here where things are starting to feel very repetitive, and that's adding to that sense of Chrome. And one of the things that we realized in the process of building Windows 8 is that we could really kind of reduce a lot of that Chrome by leveraging the concept of selection. And so what you can do as a strategy here is remove commands that apply to an individual item from that item itself and instead rely on selection. So let's say I selected a particular product and then expose those commands in the application bar. And what's particularly interesting here is that it really extends to some very powerful scenarios. So let's say I've selected an additional product. Now you can actually do some multi-selection operations really easily, providing exactly the same set of commands in the application bar, but on multiple items. So instead of actually having to favorite two or three items sequentially, I can actually select three or four items and then hit that command once. The next category of Chrome that we think about is navigation. And our philosophy around navigation is that views should be about where you're at, not where you might go. And how that translates is from a layout perspective is that we try to avoid persistent wayfinding Chrome as much as possible. One of the typical applications of that is tabs. And instead, we rely on integrating navigational elements into the content. So this is an example of what not to do. Having a series of tabs in on the top of the screen really doesn't embrace integrating tabs into the content. One of the strategies that we recommend instead of this type of UI is instead bringing up some of the content from each of those groups and placing them all on the landing page. And then these group headers aren't really Chrome. They're not this like persistent piece of text that's always visible as I'm using the application. Instead, it helps inform me about where each piece of content is coming from and how it relates to each of the individual groups in this view. And there are a couple of reasons why people leverage tabs, and we think that we've solved for them. One is because it's useful to have an overview of all the places you can go in a particular view. And then the other one is to quickly jump to that other location in a view. And we've built this feature, which is called Semantic Zoom. Some of you might be familiar with it already, but it relies on a pinch gesture inside the view. And so let's say I pinch on a screen. What we can do in this type of layout is actually provide that overview of each of the tabs in often a much richer graphical way than what I could do if I was just relying on placing some persistent textual tabs on a view. And this lets me get that overview, and it also lets me quickly jump to anywhere inside a long pannable list. And there are a couple of examples inside the release preview apps that I recommend taking a look at. So I'm going to launch the Bing News app. And you'll notice that I can pinch zoom inside that application and get an overview of each of the categories of content that's available in this view. And so I was at the beginning of the application, and I quickly pinched out, and then I tap Health. And that's at the very end of this particular view. And so instead of panning all the way there, I was able to quickly jump right to the end. So you'll see this in a lot of our applications. And the other place where you can see it is in Start. So I can pinch zoom and quickly jump between any group. I can also switch to the Applications view and do something similar. Here, once I pinch out, I actually get a series of all the letters for the alphabetical list of applications I have, and then some of the suites that are available as well. And again, this lets me quickly jump and get that overview of the content that is in that view without actually having to rely on having some tabs that are less graphical and less meaningful. The next principle is pride and craftsmanship. And pride and craftsmanship is really summed up by an attention to each and every pixel on the screen. And there are a couple of applications that are particularly relevant when we talk about pride and craftsmanship. These are typography and the use of a grid. Metro is founded on clean, beautiful typography. And we think that typography can be used to create a sense of structure and information hierarchy really effectively. And it helps kind of contribute or fill the gaps that typically you'll see used by lines and boxes. And so we think of typography as a set of defined sizes that form a type ramp and that have meaning. And Sago UI is our recommended Windows 8 UI font. And we have a type ramp of 4 sizes and a variety of weights. And we recommend using each of these weights for specific functionality. And the way to think about this type ramp is that the larger the size of the font, the more focal it is to a user as they're scanning. And so we recommend using something like a 42 point in a page header. Because the page header is kind of the anchor for the application layout, it really helps serve as a grounding element. And then 20 point can be used for subheaders, 11 point for body copy, and 9 point for more tertiary content. There are some other fonts that we recommend for different languages. For example, we recommend using Mario UI for Japanese fonts. And there are some other recommendations that you can look up on design.windows.com for some other languages. So here's a layout of a Metro style page with those fonts applied to it. So you'll notice that I'm using 42 point font for the title, 20 point font for what's likely to be a title for a specific photo or article, 11 point for some of the body copy. What's interesting here is we're actually using a couple of different weights here and colors to, again, add to the general structure of this particular layout. And so using bold for semi-bold for the title text next to the items on the right, and then a secondary color to really denote the kind of secondary nature of the accompanying text, and then some 9-point for some tertiary text. So here's another look at our type ramp. And again, what's interesting here is that you can really get quite a bit of variety using just 4 sizes by adding some variety in your weights and in your color usage. And the reason we really focus on using a small set of font sizes in a type ramp is so that a user can really easily scan a page and understand where they're meant to spend time focusing on and the general kind of importance of individual pieces. It also helps us in providing some of the information architecture of the overall page layout. One of the questions we often get around fonts is, can I use something other than Sago UI? And the answer is yes. There's another font that we often recommend for long reading scenarios, and that one's Cambria. We recommend a 3 font size type ramp for that one, 9-point, 11-point, 20-point, typically because this one's used, again, in reading scenarios. And beyond that, if your application has a very specific brand and a font that is part of that brand, it's also a reasonable extension of this principle to use another font. The one thing to keep in mind there is that we do recommend making sure that you have a small type ramp of 3 to 5 sizes that you're using, even if you're using another font, because MetroStyle UI is going to rely very much on the use of typography and space to structure the content, and we're really going to rely on removing a lot of those lines and boxes that you could typically use to add to that information architecture. The other question we get related to not using Sago UI is whether you can use a different font for your logo, or whether you're supposed to use Sago UI for a logo. Absolutely use the logos that you currently have for an application. You don't need to use Sago UI for a logo. It was something that we were seeing in some of our early partners do, but that's definitely something that you don't need to use. So if you have a logo that you're already using, feel free to continue using that. Often we'll see logos placed where a title might be placed. So if you're looking at this page, where a header would go, we'll sometimes place a logo. Make sure it's proportionally that same size, and you should be good to go. The next aspect of leveraging that focus on pixels and layout is around using the grid. And again, the grid is something that's very much inspired by modern Swiss design. And it's leveraged to provide kind of a readable presentation of content through alignment. And for those who aren't overly familiar with the grid system, we're not really providing any visible grid lines. We're providing that grid and that sense of structure through negative space and the alignment of items, and using proportion to convey the relative importance of a piece of content, the same way we were doing this for typography. Our basic grid is expressed in 2 forms, in units and subunits. And our subunits are 5 pixels by 5 pixels. Our units are 20 pixels by 20 pixels. These numbers are important for scaling. So as much as possible, we recommend making sure that your layouts are expressed in multipliers of 5 pixels. We'll be talking about exactly how and why and how this plugs in during our talk on scaling this afternoon, but keep this in mind. Here's the type on the grid, and what's really interesting here is that it starts to become clear what the relationship between our fonts and the grid is. So we've specifically chosen these font sizes to align well with our typographic grid. And we recommend aligning any text on a unit, so on a 20-pixel grid line. And one of the advantages this has is that it makes it very obvious the relative importance of an individual piece of text. And so I could place a header and a subheader on a single line, and it really is very clear what the focus of my attention should be. So a good example of this is actually in the apps view. If I search for something, you'll notice that the result string is actually using 20-point text, and we're using a 42-point for start. So we use this concept of a grid and this idea of units and subunits in the layout of all of our content and also in the layout of our typography. And we have some recommended sizes that we use for some of our layouts. There is some room for creativity here. And so the things to keep in mind is leverage multipliers of 5 pixels when you're defining spacing between items, and think about proportion having meaning. So in a standard grid application that aligns to our guidance, we'll typically use 2 subunits to space elements, so that translates to 10 pixels, and then 80 pixels of space between groups of items. And there, the proportionality is important because that smaller spacing between the elements in one group really help define that those items are related, whereas that 80 pixel gap helps provide a marker that the items are in different groups and therefore less related. Here's an example of that same layout with all of our grids overlaid on top of them. And there are a couple of things that are interesting here to note. We're really kind of paying attention to margins, and we'll talk a little bit more about those in a second. But then the other thing that's really interesting is that you'll notice that text is baseline aligned, and so that subtitle is actually aligned with the item title. And again, it helps provide a sense of clarity and readability to be able to use a grid when we lay out content, especially when we're not relying on lines and boxes. Some other recommended spacing. We recommend using 5 units of space before you align a header. A slightly larger space for the initial margin, 120 pixels. In combination, what these serve to provide is a silhouette. And that silhouette is functional as well. So actually having this amount of space on the left and on the top gives an indication to the user about the panning direction. And so as well as providing some visual breathing room, there's also some functionality associated with the silhouette. So here's our newsreader example in all its beauty, metrified. And you'll notice a couple of things. We are placing content, so it gets cut off intentionally in the right-hand side. And again, providing a hint that more content is available to the right. And if you overlay the silhouette, you'll notice again that we're using that 120 pixel space in the left margin, 100 pixels at the top. And it looks remarkably like this picture that one of our usability participants drew after he'd been using an early version of Windows 8. And so this is fundamentally one of the kind of characteristics of metro-style apps, the idea of a very defined silhouette that is used across an application. So if you're going to deviate the silhouette a little bit and not use these standard sizing, we recommend making sure you're using that silhouette across the application and deviate very intentionally. Don't get it off by a couple of pixels. Don't align the title 120 pixels down and make the left margin 100 pixels. If you're going to deviate, make sure you're deviating in a very kind of intentional way. But as much as possible, use our standard silhouette. It works really well. And you can see that when we lay it out on a number of different applications, it does become a defining characteristics of the visual layouts of metro-style applications. If you go to any one of our Bing apps, like the newsreader, you'll notice that they have a slightly different silhouette. And there, they've used exactly the same left margin, but then spent a little bit of time actually moving some of the logo and group content a little bit further up. And that was very intentionally done because the focus was primarily on the content, and the key focus of this application is on that headline. And so it made sense to not make that title string the focus of this particular application layout. So that's what I mean when we talk about intentional deviation from the typical silhouette. So here's another example. Again, one of the things we talked about was if you're going to build an app, make sure that the silhouette is applied consistently. And so these are a number of different screens that are all part of the same sample application. One of the things that we discussed earlier was the idea of size and proportion having meaning. Typography, the size of items that you're going to be using does imply how much time a user should be spending on that particular item, and it really helps focus their attention. So think about size and proportion as you're building out your application. Here's an interesting example of an application that you could build with some of our inbox controls, specifically the list view. You'll notice that this doesn't necessarily have the same kind of boxiness of that standard application that we showed. That's something that comes with Visual Studio if you're at all familiar with it. And if you compile the default grid project, you'll end up with that kind of fairly generic looking list view. The list view is actually pretty powerful. And from a design perspective, what's interesting here is the list view has a couple of constraints. And one of those is that we express the size of items as multipliers of each other. And so you'll notice that if I were to take this application, I could express the size of each of these items as multipliers of each other. The smallest item being this one on the right, and using kind of a square that's about that size. But using squares and rectangles that are multipliers of each other doesn't have to be boring. This application layout has a very clear focus. This first item is where I'm going to be spending most of my time. The next principle is be fast and fluid. And it at its core is around embracing the transitions between screens and the interaction, the interactivity of metro-style applications, and making sure that there's continuity through motion as you're interacting with the Windows 8 application. And we think that motion brings life to metro design language. And on its own, because Metro is very much focused on reductionism, it can be somewhat plain, but where it really comes to life is when you start animating it and when you start tying these screens together in a really beautiful, compelling ways. Purposeful animations tie the experience together and really tell a story. So let's say that bringing up the charms had no animation to it. It just looked like that. Kind of looks like it came from nowhere. It doesn't really tell me anything about how the system works. If instead I swipe in from the right-hand side, and I'll do that a couple of times so you can see the animation. you'll notice I get a lot more information about how the system behaves. I suddenly have this concept that the charms live on the right-hand side, and I can bring them in by swiping from the right-hand side, and it reinforces a lot of the interaction models that we have in the system today. Purposeful animations really do the job of tying experiences together so that they tell a story. If you go to the start screen, for example, and go to search, and I tap in the search box, the soft keyboard comes up, and it's coming up from the bottom. Again, it's providing some grounding and some transitions between the application and its different states and the different pieces of UI that come in and go away. There's an animation library that we provide for application developers that will provide you with scenario-based animations. These are all focused on individual scenarios. And so what's interesting here is you don't necessarily have to think about animations as being, oh, I want a crossfade here, and what does it mean? Think about the scenario, and we typically have a recommendation for the type of animation you're going to want to use here. The other thing to think about when we talk about being fast and fluid is ergonomics and touch. So design with hands and fingers and the sloppiness and the size of a finger in mind. Because people are sloppy when it comes to touch, you don't want to provide immediate visual feedback for all interactions so that people can course correct if they don't really hit things quite right. A quick note on panning. Let content flow edge to edge. And panning along a single axis is recommended for stability and also to support selection. So if I go to the start screen, I can pan going left to right. And what's really nice is this view is very stable because it really only pans in one direction. And then it becomes really powerful when I can swipe in the direction that's orthogonal to panning to select. So if I drag down on a title, I can select it and then access contextual commands on the left. The thing to avoid is boxing in content. It doesn't really feel as immersive if content is boxed in. And we definitely recommend leveraging the long edge of the screen and therefore primarily supporting horizontally panning views. And think about how to simplify your UI. Being fast and fluid is more about just look and feel and transitions and accounting for touch. Simplify the flow. Think about leveraging some of the system capabilities that we have in Windows 8, like the ability to roam settings and preferences, or save application state on the user's behalf if they switch away from you, and show errors in lines. The last principle is authentically digital. The fourth principle is authentically digital, and this one speaks to embracing the fact that we are pixels on the screen, and we don't necessarily have to tie ourselves to real-world metaphors. And one of the more interesting examples that we have around this is the idea of semantic zoom, and the fact that we're really going beyond just zooming out content when you're pinching, we're actually changing the representation and showing you new and different information to enable scenarios like jumping to the photos from the circus, which are undersea, or from the water park, which might be several thousand pictures away. There are a lot of interesting creative solutions to leveraging semantic zoom and showing really compelling information. So let's say you had an online shopping application, and one of the things you were trying to do was highlight individual items while you're semantic zooming. You could take a few of those key elements and actually highlight them, really incentivize the user to jump to nuts or vegetables, which might be healthier. Again, another example, let's say you're an ebook retailer and you have a lot of different categories of books. You could show some interesting graphical representations here when you semantically zoom, like the number of books based on the size of the item itself, or the popularity. When it comes to mutual funds, this is probably my favorite examples. You can highlight some really kind of relevant and interesting information when you semantically zoom, like, hey, what stocks are doing well and which ones aren't? That way I'll know where to quickly jump and catch the highlights for this particular fund doing well or poorly. When it comes to mail, you can show something like the number of unread items, high priority items, and really change the information you're presenting based on the category. So it doesn't all have to be pivoted on a single type of content. A quick note on infographics and glyphs. There was a time and place for this type of infographic and glyphs, and we think we've moved past that. We don't think we need to take as many of these real-world metaphors forward when we're building Metro design style UI. We think that focusing on simple designs that are more about the function that's being provided by the command is more powerful than having overly decorative icons. The last principle is win is one, and there are a couple of ways that this this shows up when you think about Metro style apps. One is leveraging contracts. I alluded to these earlier. There we go. There are four contracts that we provide in Box, and these are some key system functionality, and these are search, share, devices, and settings. This is where users are going to expect to go for these contracts and this type of functionality. So as you're building out applications and creating your designs, think about how you can plug in here. And leverage these entry points. These entry points are going to be always available no matter where you are within an application, and they provide really great jumping points for functionality. And so let's say I'm in a video application and I'm watching a video and it's a little bit boring. What I can do straight from that immersive video watching experience is bring out the charms and tap search and search for a new video. So that we basically do the job on your behalf of getting some of that Chrome out of the way, but keeping it consistently available. There's some other contracts that you can also plug into, like File Picker, and we'll go into some of those details later this afternoon. The other thing to think about when it comes to winning as one is leveraging the UI model that we've been building through some of the controls that we're providing, through things like the charms. Reduce concepts here by leveraging what's already out in the ecosystem and aligning to some of the mechanisms that applications are embracing. So leveraging things like the edge. Give people just that one rock to lift. The touch language is going to be something everyone's familiar with. Don't create new gestures. Leverage the ones we already have. So let's go back to our much-loved RSS reader. And you know, as a reminder, the principles we walked through today were around really leveraging a lot of the Metro design style principles around reductionism and removing Chrome and embracing things like removing tab and not having consistent wayfinding Chrome, leveraging things like semantic zoom and charms. And so this is my last slide. I think that gives me a little bit of time for questions. But think about these principles as you're designing your applications, and this will get you off to a really good start. James, how are we doing questions?
You're doing great on time, and you're doing good on questions. How about we take a couple questions from the room first?
Okay.
Is there anybody who has a question to If you can repeat the question.
Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
Why are the terms prone, charms, and contracts?
The terms, did you say?
Yeah. Oh.
So the question was why the terms charms, chromes, chrome, and contracts? Three good C words. So chrome is a word really that we just made up, and it was a way of kind of unifying our thinking around what was serving up as visual distractions and interactions that were really getting in the way of the primary purpose of an app. So that's just a term we came up with. In terms of charms and contracts, the story behind charms is kind of interesting. We have code words a lot when we're building Windows 8, and charms was actually one of the code words that we were using way back when. And when it came to discussing what we were going to actually name the features with marketing, they actually really liked the name, and so we just stuck with it. Contracts is more of a developer-facing term, but one that had some meaning associated with it that people were somewhat could relate to from a development perspective, and I think hints to things that developers are familiar with, like the idea of APIs. So that one I think was somewhat founded or somewhat underlines the functionality.
Cool, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got a question from Jesse in Chicago who asks, how does swiping from the edge work with a mouse?
Yeah, great question. I think a demo is in order. So the question was, swiping from the edge works great for touch. How do I do that with mouse? And the way that you can invoke the charms via mouse or bring up the app bar is you can actually use any of the corners to access the left and right edge. So if I take my mouse and I bring it to the right-hand corner, either on the top or the bottom, I can bring up the charms. And we didn't talk about it specifically, but I'll let you know about it anyways. If I bring my mouse to the bottom or top left-hand corner, I can access the list of all my recently used applications. And if I want to access the app bar, I can right-click anywhere on the UI to bring up the app bar. And if I want to select an item, I can just right-click that item, and I'll get the contextual commands for it as well.
Thanks. Another question from the room, perhaps? Anybody?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it seems like kind of in the examples that you talked about, Metro was expressed in ways of consuming content.
Mm-hmm.
What about situations where you're creating content or where the interaction is the content? Are there any ideas or principles that apply to that?
Yeah, I think a lot. So the question was around how do the principles apply to application experiences where you're creating content and as opposed to just consuming content? We think a lot of the same principles apply there. I think there we think about the ideas that you're trying to convey as the commands. And so there's probably some commands that will be less relevant in a productivity scenario. So something like file management will be less relevant, and so something that you probably put off screen or elsewhere. But then something like using or selecting a color in a paintbrush in a drawing app is going to be part of the primary experience, and so something that would be on Canvas. So there aren't any additional principles we really think of there. I think there the one shift you end up having to make is that the productivity scenarios and the commands that are primary to creating that content become the content for that application. Another one?
Yeah. Can you talk, and this is from Rhea in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
She asks, can you talk about the decision to use points as a measurement rather than pixels? I think she's referring to the font.
Mm-hmm.
Presentation is talking about a mix of pixels and points for apps.
Mm-hmm. So the question from Priya was around why we use points when we're talking about typography as opposed to pixels. And one of the primary reasons is that's how we define them in CSS. So we end up using point sizes there. We have chosen the point sizes so that they fit well in that 20 pixel grid. So you can declare the font sizes and point sizes, and you should be good to go. If you're going to go and create your own typographic ramp, what we recommend doing is making sure that you're going to pick some font sizes that will fit well in your grid. So that's one thing to think about. There you're going to have to do some of the translation yourself and make sure that you're aligning fonts in an appropriate way. Cool.
Another question, final question from the room before we get back to the web. Anyone? No? Final call? Okay. There's lots of questions coming in Twitter and email.
Okay. Do you want to do one more from online?
Yeah. We've got time for one more.
Okay.
So this is from Alina in Mountain View, and she asks, do you think that most of today's Windows 7 desktop apps could be converted to Metro design style on Windows 8, including, for example, developer tools like Visual Studio?
So a question from Melina from Mountain View around whether she thinks that most desktop-style apps could become Metro-style apps, and whether Visual Studio in particular could become a Metro-style app. The Visual Studio question is a little bit easier to answer, so I'll start with that one. We've done a lot of work when it comes to the Metro-style application framework to ensure that Metro-style apps are at some level sandbox from accessing some key system functionality that's core to some desktop applications that manage your system or build out applications. So in the case of Visual Studio, fundamentally it can't really live in the Metro design style app application framework. In general, I would say that many desktop applications can definitely be translated to a Metro-style app. There are definitely some repercussions or some implications of doing something like that. So that's also something to think about. If you're working on an application that really relies heavily on having a ton of commands that are always accessible at a single click, let's say some sort of hardcore word processor or Photoshop application, that probably doesn't lend itself that well to Metro design style, but you could think about an application providing similar functionality in a much more simplified way, and I think that would work really well.
Cool.
Okay, thank you.
Very much.